This time on Weather Brains, predictions that we'll see an active Atlantic hurricane season this year and the reasons behind those predictions.
The way the atmospheric conditions are now, they look like we'll have a pretty active season.
We talk with hurricane expert Dr. William Gray.
And I bet he knows which way a hurricane spins in the northern hemisphere, too.
Don't start that again, please.
Dr. Gray has a thing or two to say about people connecting hurricanes with global warming. You'll hear that, too. Also this time, it's Noah's birthday. No, we're not talking about the Noah who built the ark, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Kevin and Tracy Selly take a look at Noah's many achievements and accomplishments benefiting mankind. Okay, Kev, the guys want to know more about this Tracy lady.
She's 10 times better looking than she sounds.
Also this week, a new feature, This Week in Weather. Kevin Selly brings us a quick rundown on weather-related events happening around us, plus the continuing struggle for New Orleans to get back on its feet after Katrina.
It's just been in the last couple of weeks that the first new homes, actual new construction, not redos or fixes, were just finished about 2 to 3 weeks ago. It's taken that long.
And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks at a time when 30,000 men tried to take on the Mississippi River and lost. It's all coming up. It's episode number 63 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about weather, produced by the Weather Company. I'm David Black. Along with me for this ride, Kevin Selly, Bill Murray, Brian Peters, and J.B. Elliott. Mr. Elliott, how goes it?
Goes good. Going real good. I'm very happy. Very pleased.
Very glad to hear that. Kevin Selly in the great state of Texas. How are things there for you, sir?
We had snow on the bluebonnets across Texas this past weekend, David, so it was great.
That's an unusual sight, isn't it?
Yes, very much so, but it was fun. I think everybody enjoyed it.
Well, I have to throw in something personal right at the start. I'm a Texas native and have great love for the bluebonnet. It is a gorgeous flower, and I'll bet they are really in bloom in Texas about now, despite the snowflakes.
It is honestly the best season for bluebonnets in recent memory, at least the past couple of years. Just carpets of blue everywhere you look.
That sounds wonderful. Speaking of flakes, Brian Peters, how? Oh, I'm just kidding. It's just starting it off on a bad note. Go ahead. Go ahead, Brian. Let me have it.
I also have lived in Texas and love the blue bonnets, but I would match Kevin's blue to our yellow and gold as a result of the pollen.
Oh, man.
Ah. Yes. But, you know, Central Alabama and the nation averted a disaster thanks to a few clouds. Over the weekend, we were expecting record lows, and we did set some record lows in the state of Alabama. But fortunately, the Central Alabama area where the peach crop was threatened, it looks like it survived thanks to some clouds that came in about 3 o'clock in the morning, put just enough of a cloud blanket in there. We dropped below freezing, but it looks like we didn't get down into the mid-20s like we were anticipating. So hopefully the nation's going to be able to enjoy those Chilton County peaches.
And if you have never sampled a Chilton County peach, perhaps you're one of the folks listening to us from some of the other states of the Union, all I can tell you is you're missing something pretty tasty. So maybe there'll
be... They are wonderful.
Yeah, maybe there'll be a few peaches to go around. Bill Murray with us for this netcast. Bill, I'm a little shocked you're not on the road somewhere. Or are you?
I know, I've missed you guys.
Well,
the last few weeks I've had engagements every Monday night and... Couldn't be available, so I'm especially thrilled to be here tonight.
Well, you know what? We get listener emails and survey requests and such that tell us in a pretty substantial way that people enjoy your feature, This Week in Weather History, and I know you've put together a good one. I have to confess I've heard a sneak preview of it, and it's very interesting. So This Week in Weather History with Bill Murray and Bill Murray Live, it's kind of an extra double treat. It's kind of like you get the sprinkles along with the whipped cream and the fudge.
You are awfully nice, Dave. I sure do enjoy doing that, This Week in Weather History. It's a lot of fun.
Well, you're just a weather geek like the rest of us. Speaking of weather geeks, we're a pretty devoted weather geek crowd. Now, Before I go into this, let me just say quickly that one very well-known weather geek, James Spann, is not up with us on this netcast because he's doing the Little League ball game with the sun thing again this week, but he'll join us again probably next time. But the weather geeks here, being the geeks that we are, really enjoy bringing weather to you just in a variety of ways. And Kevin Selly, I'm going to put you on the spot because we've got a new feature that starts this week, and this is sort of a way to bring our listeners weather-related news in a quick and easy-to-digest manner. And since it's your idea, I'm trying to think here, what would we want to call a show each week about weather?
Well, I was thinking that I would have to ride the coattails of Bill Murray after we got such a great response on This Week in Weather History on our listener survey. And so I was thinking, how about This Week in Weather?
Wow, what a shock. Let's give it a whirl.
This Week in Weather from weatherparty.com. Always one of the most anticipated announcements on the weather calendar is the hurricane season prediction from Dr. William Gray and his team at Colorado State University, and they are predicting a, quote, very active season with 17 named storms. Stay tuned for David's interview with Dr. Gray coming up. A spring blizzard pounded parts of the Great Lakes and the Northeast last week. Wheelock, Vermont reported 13 inches of snow, 14 in North Conway, New Hampshire, and 11 inches in Portland, Maine.
22.9 in Eustis, probably about 70, 80 miles north of Portland.
James Brown is a hydrometeorological technician at the National Weather Service in Portland. Heavy, wet snow took down a number of tree branches, which meant power outages, not uncommon this time of year.
Pretty unusual to get this much snow all at once in April. It's not unusual for it to snow in April, just not to snow to this magnitude.
Hurricane Katrina was more than 18 months ago, but the mountain of fraud cases continues to grow. The General Accounting Office has referred more than 22,000 cases to the Katrina Task Force and concludes FEMA has recovered less than 1% of the $1 billion given under fraudulent claims. One estimate suggests there is enough investigative work to keep authorities busy for 5 to 8 more years. From Valencia, Spain, weather frustration for the competitors in the Louis Vuitton Act 13 yacht race. The Louis Vuitton Cup is one of the races on the road to the America's Cup held in June and July. The entire fleet sat in open water for nearly 4 hours before canceling the race. The problem? No wind. And finally, from Barrie, Vermont, a very special weather vane purchased in 1903 to sit atop the local fire station.
It is a horse-drawn fire wagon. There's a team of two horses at the front, and there's a fireman at the front with the reins in his hand, and then there's another fireman at the back manipulating a big, it's like a horizontal wheel like you might see on a ship.
That was Karen Lane, who runs the local library in Barrie, where the weather vane has been on display since the mid-1980s. It seems there was a strange rash of weather vane thefts in the area around that time. Recently, a library visitor offered a fairly large sum of money for the one-of-a-kind piece, which prompted the town to try and figure out how much it was worth. An antiques appraiser in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, says at auction, the weather vane could fetch up to $1.2 million. For more weather news and information, visit weatherparty.com.
I'm thinking that Bill Murray could afford to put that weather vane on top of his new hotel that we should give a shameless plug for, the Tutwiler Hotel in downtown Birmingham. What do you think, Bill?
I think I've seen a couple around town that I'm going to shinny up, and they might get sawed off during the middle of the night if they're going for that price.
Well, there you go. That's This Week in Weather History. Or not Weather History, This Week in Weather, David.
See, we've got to learn this, too. We have This Week in Weather, plus we have This Week in Weather History. We're all going to have to get used to this. But
we all have to change the name.
Yeah, a lot of fun, though. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and that's right.
Yeah, we'll be looking forward to that as time goes on. And, right. Bill, speaking of your hotel that you're working on, In Birmingham, Alabama, for people who do not know who you are, maybe a new listener to Weather Brains, you're heavily involved in the hospitality business and have your hands heavily so in this hotel in downtown. My question to you for the Birmingham Hotel is, are there going to be little weather monitoring stations in all the rooms or on all the floors? Because you are a serious weather geek.
Well, we've got a lot of technology, but I haven't, beyond, you know, just a little simple weather forecast, we don't have anything really special yet. I've got to come up with something up my sleeve for that.
All right. Well, I just thought I'd put you on the spot and see. You never know. But I suspect that when the time comes later in the year, perhaps, there will be some sort of hurricane information that people can access in some way from your place or just about anywhere else. The latest Atlantic hurricane season prediction from Colorado State University's forecasting team with Dr. William Gray and Phil Klotzbach has come out. And if the outlook is right, we can count on an active hurricane season. You just heard Kevin talking about that in This Week in Weather. The team's prediction calls for 17 named storms this year, 9 of those predicted to become hurricanes, and 5 of the 9 would become Category 3 or greater. Category 3 storm has winds of 111 to 130 miles an hour, so we're not talking about just a brisk breeze here. We caught up with Dr. William Gray at his office in Colorado and asked him why he expects 2007 to be an active season.
We're in an active era. You know, since 1995, the thermohaline circulation has been going strong. And we've had a lot of major storms since then, 1995 on. And we're in that era. That's one thing. But even besides that, the North Atlantic temperatures are very warm, and the arrangement of pressures are such that are favorable. But perhaps the biggest thing, we've upped our forecast from our early December forecast. We were calling for 14 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major ones then. Now we've upped it to 17 named storms, 9 hurricanes, and 5 major ones. Now the reason we've done that is this El Nino that came on so unexpectedly last year in August. You remember that?
Yes, sir.
It came on, and we over forecast. We had a bad forecast last year.
Had to revise your forecast downward.
We had to revise it down. Actually, we had no landfalling hurricanes last year, the 11th year since 45 that we've had that. But it was somewhat below average year. We had 9 named storms, 5 hurricanes, and 2 major ones last year. But it seemed like more of a bust than people thought because there were no landfalling hurricanes. Now, this El Nino came in and shut it down, but this El Nino has rapidly vanished. We've never seen anything from early December through the end of February. This El Nino is gone, and we've been replaced by cold water in the eastern equatorial Pacific now.
Do we know why the El Nino would vanish
Well, no, we don't. Actually, we know that the trade winds have picked up, and when you have trades, you have more upwelling of cold water and things, but why did the trades pick up? No, we don't have a good understanding of that. But the El Nino definitely left, and we're projecting cold water now for the eastern equatorial Pacific, and that's a very favorable thing for tropical storms, too.
What are the odds, then, of a major storm striking some part of the U.S. mainland?
Well, we have that at 74%. The long-term average is 52%. The odds are for more landfall than we typically have. The odds favor that. Doesn't mean it's going to take place, though.
You still have concerns you've expressed in the past about people's storm readiness along the coasts?
Yeah, I'm sure there are people that don't take it very seriously. But at the same time, I think the great landfall activity we've seen in 2004 and 5 has sort of freaked people out, and they may be going too far the other way. We don't think this season will be as active as the 2004 and 2005 seasons have been.
With every year, you learn some lessons about nature and the weather. Is your confidence building in your accuracy at this point?
Well, I've learned a lot. This is my 24th year involved with this. Actually, I'm the second author on the forecast. Phil Klotzbach and me put it out. And, I've learned how tough it is over the years to do these forecasts. But I do know there are people along the southeast coast. Everybody knows no one can tell for sure what the coming season's going to be. And I think most people realize that, but they want to know how the ocean and atmospheric conditions 3, 6, 9 months before the season look. What are the odds? And that's what we can give. We can give odds of this. So The way the atmospheric conditions are now, they look like we'll have a pretty active season. Now, when I've been involved over 50 years in studying the storms, I used to go to Florida every summer and fly into storms. And most of my work has been in studying tropical cyclone structure, intensity change, genesis, motion, things like that. When I did this, when I used to go there, we had no idea what the coming season would be. We had absolutely no clues. We could say nothing. The only thing you could do is forecast what the climatology says. Now we can say something. Doesn't work in all years, but it works in the majority of years. The big thing I want to push is that I'm not at all a fan of this human-induced global warming. I think the changes we've seen are quite within the natural bounds of things. This has been hyped way too much. The storms have not gotten worse since the 1970s. I've been trying to save the world from worry about global warming. It's overhyped tremendously. I've been appalled some at the people stepping in and trying to make something over these busy hurricane seasons of 2004 and 5, saying they're a result of global warming and things. I think those people that have overhyped global warming, we should start having Nuremberg trials with them.
That's Dr. William Gray, Colorado State University. Tell us how you really feel there, Dr. Gray. You know, there's something about Dr. Gray that I really appreciate, guys, and that is the fact that he's just a down-to-earth, honest forecaster. If they write a forecast that's not exactly a real good one, they don't cover it up. They don't pretend like it never happened. He brings it right out in the open and says it was not a good forecast. And I don't hear that kind of honesty all that much in the world today. So that's one of the things about him that I appreciate.
He's really something. Didn't he say something a little more specific about Al Gore and the movie, Bill? Didn't you come across something on that?
Yeah, he actually fired a shot across his bow. He said he was a gross alarmist for the movie An Inconvenient Truth. I think his quote was something out of USA Today. Said he's one of those guys who preaches the end of the world type of things. I think he's doing a great disservice, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He said at the National Hurricane Center Conference, or the National Hurricane Conference in New Orleans, where he was the closing speaker. So you've got a little quote about that, I think, that Dr. Gray might have dropped on you, didn't you, David?
Sure did, Bill. I spoke with Dr. Gray right before he left for that conference, and here's what he had to say about that.
I've been appalled some at the people stepping in and trying to make something over these busy hurricane seasons of 2004 and 5, saying they're a result of global warming and things.
Did you follow Vice President Gore's comments on Capitol Hill about global warming?
Yes, I did. I don't believe any of it. He is. I've written a review of the Gore movie and book, and he's half his facts are wrong, the other half are over exaggerated. And he doesn't know what he's talking about. In my view, he's done a great disservice to alarm people the way he has when we have so many other real problems to face up to in this country.
So he's really coming out swinging about this, and he watched the former vice president when he made his appearance on Capitol Hill, and just has very strong feelings about it, that he continues to make his feelings known very strongly in the science and political world every chance that he gets.
And I bet he knows which way a hurricane spins in the northern hemisphere, too.
Don't start that again, please.
You think, huh?
He's been researching hurricanes longer than some of the people who are opposing him have been on the planet. So I would wager that he knows which way they rotate.
David, speaking of things and people that have been around for a long, long time, J.B. Elliott and Brian Peters are almost as old as the government agency that they used to work for. And NOAA, which oversees the National Weather Service, is marking a very special anniversary this year. NOAA has organized an unbelievably data-rich website to mark their 200th anniversary. And I and a special guest announcer, who I won't announce the name of until the end of the piece, but a very good-looking announcer as well, take a look at some of the weather highlights of the site.
Just about all of us have heard of the National Weather Service. Many of us will have heard of the United States Weather Bureau. Few of us, though, may have heard of the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey of 1807. Commissioned by Congress and President Thomas Jefferson in 1807, the survey was a recognition by the country of the importance of maritime interests and operations to the young nation.
The mission was to create the most detailed nautical charts of the U.S. coastline to date and was led by a Swiss-born immigrant named Ferdinand Hassler. Mr. Hassler proposed a geodetic triangulation network as a way to make topographic surveys of the U.S. shoreline, as well as hydrographic surveys of the growing harbors and offshore waters to provide safe and efficient navigation of the nation's waterways.
Geodetic, by the way, is an area of mathematics that helps determine the size and shape of the Earth by using exact positions on the surface. And don't worry, I had to look it up too. So the survey was done, and thus was born the organization that eventually became NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which this year celebrates its 200th birthday. NOAA is the parent company, if you will, of today's National Weather Service.
In celebration, NOAA has set up a pretty cool website that looks back on some of the highlights of its past. That site, linked on our website, weatherbrains.com, hosts a number of top 10 lists from NOAA history, and we thought we'd pick some of the best weather-related stuff broken down into four categories.
The first is History Makers, and the first NOAA weather history maker is Cleveland Abbey, 1838 to 1916. Mr. Abbey joined the federal government in 1870 when it formed the United States Weather Bureau and was considered to be the only individual in the country with any practical experience in weather forecasting based on scientific principles. He set up the first scientific observing system and developed criteria and methods for training new personnel. In the early days of the agency, he was the only source of weather forecasts, which he called probabilities, which led to his nickname, Old Prob. David Johnson, 1924 to 2005, was one of the four founding members of the MSA, or Meteorological Satellite Activities Branch, in 1956, which is the group that led to what we know of today as NESDIS, or National Environmental Satellite Data and Information Service. In the 1960s, Mr. Johnson brokered a deal with the People's Republic of China to share satellite weather information and also established a weather hotline between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. Mr. Johnson's contributions are still recognized today with the NOAA David Johnson Award, given each year to one young scientist who encourages new thinking, problem-solving, or applications of satellite data.
The second top 10 list is breakthroughs and includes the first climate model developed in the late 1960s at NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, New Jersey. That early model represented the first time scientists and meteorologists tied the ocean and atmosphere together to see how they worked and affected the climate system of the planet. Climate modeling is at the heart of the global warming debate today. Also making the top 10 under breakthroughs is the development and advancement of Doppler radar and its importance in learning some of the processes inside a thunderstorm that lead to tornado development. May 24, 1973 is recognized as a benchmark date as the newly commissioned Doppler radar at NOAA's National Severe Storms Laboratory allowed researchers to see inside a thunderstorm that struck Union City, Oklahoma, and begin to understand the persistent rotating updraft previously unknown in supercell storms.
Under the heading of Historic Events in NOAA Top Tens, the first Earth Day on April 22, 1970, a project conceived by Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson to raise awareness of environmental concerns, it is estimated that as much as 10% of the nation's population participated in the first Earth Day. Hurricane Katrina makes the list. August 29, 2005 brought devastation to parts of coastal Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. The storm is blamed for taking more than 1,500 lives and damaging or destroying 275,000 homes. Damage estimates top $100 billion. Another big storm makes the top 10, the 1993 Storm of the Century, the one many people call the Blizzard of 93. It was the first time in history the National Weather Service was able to forecast a storm of such size and intensity 5 days out and provide blizzard warnings 2 days in advance. April 1st, 1960 saw the first pictures of clouds from space from the Tyros 1 satellite. Tyros stands for Television and Infrared Observation Satellite, and ground crews recorded the images on 35mm film so photographs and projections could be made.
And finally, one more top 10 list is titled Foundation Datasets and includes the Cooperative Observer Network Program, started in the 1890s and today includes more than 11,000 volunteer citizens across the country who take daily weather readings and contribute over 1 million hours of service per year. The Tropical Atmosphere Ocean Array, a series of deep ocean buoys, started in 1985, collect ocean atmospheric data and help with predictions of El Niño. And the last, but certainly not the least, of weather breakthroughs is the development in the 1950s of NOAA Weather Radio. The U.S. Weather Bureau began by broadcasting aviation weather on two radio stations, and today NOAA has expanded the system to 960 stations across the country. In 2004, the Department of Homeland Security joined NOAA in using the weather radio to broadcast all hazards, including events such as Amber Alerts, 911 telephone outages, a host of natural disasters, and terrorism.
200 years of incredible scientific advancement and education, and Weather Brains celebrates along with NOAA by encouraging you to visit the 200 Years of Science, Service, and Stewardship website, linked on our site at weatherbrains.com.
So congratulations and happy birthday to JB and Brian on their careers at NWS and NOAA. And I imagine that Bill has already found this site. And if he has not, I think we probably won't see him for a month after he does, guys.
Hey, that was a great resume.
I am having a field day with that. That's great.
Really? Oh, my God. Have you not seen this thing, Bill?
After you sent it out today, I saw it, and it's really a great site.
It just goes on for days and days, and the links to other stuff that are not even directly associated with that site will take you for weeks and months after that. So it's really worthwhile, and of course is on the website. Oh, I should mention the talented person who joined.
We had a question about that, Kev. Just who would this young lass be?
She needs to be on TV.
Sounds really good, doesn't she? Don't you think?
I'm just going to take a wild guess here. She wouldn't have the last name Selly, would she?
Well, yeah, she's 10 times better looking than she sounds. So she's lucky enough. Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have her as my wife. That is my wife, Tracy Selly, and I thank her for doing that with me.
Well,
Tracy needs to be on TV.
Tracy should probably be on Weather Brains more regularly, is what I'm thinking.
Yes.
Hey, there's an idea.
You know, I don't think we've come to think of it. I don't believe we've had a female announcer on here before. Have we, guys? I don't remember anybody.
What's the deal there, David?
We're not trying to be, you know.
Well, we couldn't get Heidi.
Yeah, that's right. We got Heidi'd, so maybe Tracy is the ticket. But anyway, fun piece. Good piece.
She did great.
Good when we have the vodcast instead of the podcast, huh?
There you go.
I know what's going to happen if we do a vodcast. They're not going to want to be looking at the guys.
Exactly. There's a reason we haven't done one already, right, David?
Let's not go there.
You see, you guys got me all thrown off track now. I don't even know what's next anymore. I'm not even thinking anymore. Well, we were kind of roundtable talking, and one of the pieces that I just wanted to mention real quickly, and you touched on this a while back, Kevin, in This Week in Weather, and that was about Katrina. I don't know if you guys have followed this item in the news, but we don't need to spend any time talking about what happened when Katrina hit, the incredible response or lack thereof by federal government, state, local governments. A lot of criticism about that. But now there is a whole new battle shaping up as New Orleans tries to rebuild. I don't know if you guys saw this, but there is a dispute growing over how $7.5 billion in federal government money is going to be handed out to help people rebuild. The money involves 120,000 homeowners, people who lost their homes or had their homes heavily damaged by Katrina. The state is, I'm going to use the word ticked off or concerned, that a new requirement means that money, aid checks that'll be coming to these people will come jointly to them and to their mortgage lenders. And they're concerned that the money may bypass going to the owners and instead go to the mortgage lenders who, you know, probably defaulted on their payments. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all works out. A federal official said the government was relying on lenders to act fairly to New Orleans homeowners. We'll just have to see.
Yeah, that always happens.
Yeah, we'll just have to see how that happens. But when you rely on the government to be fair about a lot of things, I don't know how you always come out of that. But I thought that was interesting. And, you know, that's just one more item that people down there have to deal with as they try to rebuild.
I thought it was really amazing. I just saw it's been maybe 2 to 3 weeks tops that, you know, we're 18 months past this thing now. But it's just been in the last couple of weeks that the first new homes, actual new construction, not redos or fixes, were just finished about 2 to 3 weeks ago. It's taken that long, David.
Yeah, and I suspect I have not been to New Orleans since Katrina hit, but more people say that you can still go down there and see so much evidence of the damage. You know, it's really hard to imagine the magnitude of that. And I know we've said this before, and I'm not covering any new ground, but it just gives me a new appreciation for what it's really taking to get an area, not just New Orleans, but southern Mississippi too, to get that whole area back on its feet. Bill, you've been down there, and you've seen some of that too.
Yeah, and actually, last week I met one of the vice presidents of Tulane University was in Birmingham and at the Tutwiler. And, you know, I immediately identified, you know, that she was from New Orleans, of course, started talking to her. And she said, Bill, you have no idea just the magnitude. She said, there are 150,000 homes that are destroyed. And she said, at 15,000 homes a year, it's going to take us 10 years just to get back to where we were.
Unreal. Well, anyway, we'll follow that and see what else happens. Brian Peters, what have you got? Anything you want to bring to the discussion roundtable?
Oh, you know, this global warming, we keep beating it to death. But I saw an interesting article this past week that just, I don't know, I just threw up my hands. Mountain climbers are on the bandwagon for global warming because it's getting harder and harder to find snowpack at higher elevations. Okay. Now, is that a scientific evidence or not?
Well, you just wait and see what other stories come down the pike in the coming weeks and months. We have no idea.
Hey, you know what I found, David, since we're talking global warming, and Heidi Cullen was mentioned a little earlier? Online today, there is a position now open at the Weather Channel in Atlanta for a climate correspondent.
Really?
This person will work on that program that she works on. And I, you know, it doesn't say specifically that they're looking for one side or another. In fact, I actually have seen this in two places now, and I'm trying to scan through it very quickly. But
Should we send them Span's resume?
I'm sure they would love to see that.
Let's do it.
And that's all it is anymore in the media, is just starting a fight. But the first ad that I saw for that position was really interesting because it really tried to place her in a very centrist position, which I'm not 100% sure that I agree with. But if anybody is a climate correspondent out of work, you can call the Weather Channel in Atlanta, David.
Fair enough. We'll never know her position on certain things because she chose not to talk with us.
There you go.
Hey, we had something happen of interest to our listeners. We got a telephone call on the WeatherBrains toll-free listener line. Thought we'd check it out and maybe see if we can come up with an answer.
This is Matt calling from Moody. I know we have a lot of snow lovers here in the state of Alabama. My question is, we do have a small mountain range that runs through Alabama. What if we had a range similar to out west, mountain peaks of 10,000 to 13,000 feet high? What if we had those in Alabama? How much snow winter, early spring season do you think we would get? Thanks. Have a good day.
All right, Matt. Interesting question. Let me pick on JB Elliott. Any thoughts on Matt's question, JB?
That is a good question, and we can only give him a speculative answer. Yeah, I didn't pronounce that word right.
Well,
but anyway. Yeah, speculate. We'll speculate. If we had a 10,000-foot mountain range or a 13,000-foot mountain range, it depends on the orientation of the mountain range in the state. Let's say it ran east-west across the central part of the state. With all that Gulf moisture moving northward from the Gulf of Mexico, and the temperature normally cools off at about 3.5 degrees per 1,000 feet. So by the time you got up to 10 and 13,000 feet, it would stay below freezing all winter. You'd get a lot of moisture riding up and trying to get over that mountain range, and the snowpack would be tremendous. So even an isolated single mountain peak in the middle of the state that went over 10,000 feet, I would estimate that, just guessing, that it would get over 100 inches of snow a year.
Wow. Mm. Can you imagine the forecast challenges that would be involving?
We would all leave town.
Interesting.
And think how dry the Ohio Valley would be.
Yeah. Right. The Ohio Valley would be a drought.
Oh, man. Well, tell you what, if you've got a question like that, you have all these weather geeks who are able to answer it. So if you'd like to call us and hit us with a weather question, feel free. The toll-free number is 1-888-247-8627. That's 888-247-8627. No charge in the U.S. Can't beat the price. Well, how far can a tornado carry an object? The record for that was set during this week back in 1991. And during this week in 1927, 30,000 men were trying to hold back the mighty floodwaters of the Mississippi River. Who won? It's a spectacular and destructive answer. Bill Murray has details during This Week in Weather History.
Let's look back at some interesting weather history for the week of April 10th through the 16th. Back in 1960, the Tyro satellite had only been aloft for 10 days when it took the first images of a tropical cyclone over the Coral Sea. Never again would hurricanes and typhoons go undetected. On April 10, 1979, three very intense thunderstorms produced a devastating outbreak of tornadoes in the Red River Valley of western North Texas and southern Oklahoma. A massive tornado killed 40 people at Wichita Falls in spite of excellent warnings. In 1815, the Tambora volcano in Indonesia began erupting violently. It was one of the most powerful volcanic eruptions of all time. The ash encircled the globe, reducing sunlight by as much as 15 to 20% worldwide. Global temperatures dropped as much as 7 degrees Celsius, resulting in the year without a summer in Europe and parts of North America in 1816. On April 11, 1965, the Palm Sunday outbreak of 51 tornadoes across the Midwest killed 256 people. The disaster did produce a positive result, however. Weather radio was born. And it was back in 1991 on April 11th that a personal check was blown 223 miles from Stockton, Kansas to Winnetou, Nebraska by a tornado. According to the Tornado Project, this is the longest distance ever that an object has been carried by a tornado. In 1979, much of the town of Northport, Alabama was underwater as the Warrior River crested at 19 feet above flood stage in Tuscaloosa. The flooding occurred as two waves of rainfall on the 12th dumped up to 14 inches of rain on West Alabama. The Black Blizzard of April 14, 1935 was the worst dust storm of the Dust Bowl era of the 1930s. The great quantities of black dust blew all the way to Washington, D.C., preventing politicians from ignoring the plight of the plains farmers as gritty clouds hung over the Capitol. And around 3 p.m. on April 15, 1956, an F-4 tornado tore along the western and northern fringes of the city of Birmingham, Alabama, killing 25 people. McDonald's Chapel was one of the communities along the 20-mile path. The F-5 tornado on April 8, 1998 would affect some of the same areas. This week back in 1927, the Great Mississippi River flood was raging. Tremendous rains all over the Mississippi River Valley during the preceding autumn and winter set the stage for the massive flood. The surge of floodwaters was pushing downriver toward the Mississippi Delta, bursting levees as it went. In Greenville, Mississippi, 30,000 men, including convicts and laborers, were working frantically, some at gunpoint, to raise the height of the levees. They would lose the battle on the 20th when a massive break in the levee, or a crevasse, opened at Mounds Landing. Over 1 million acres of the Delta were flooded to a depth of 10 feet. The town of Greenville, Mississippi was destroyed. David, that's This Week in Weather History.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Murray. Next time on Weather Brains, April's early cold is scaring some farmers in some parts of the southern U.S., and that could have an impact on the prices we pay for berries, peaches, and such. We'll be checking in with some folks in those businesses to find out. We hope you can join us. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks here at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Oh, and I just had a great idea. Guys, what do you think of this? When folks contact us via email, telephone, whichever, why don't we get them to let us know if they'd like to hear more Tracy? So let us hear from you if you want to hear more Tracy Selle. Email again is question@weatherbrains.com. If you want to call us and just say more Tracy, that's fine too. The number again, 1-888-247-8627. 247 So already one vote, yes. 1-888-247-8627. So we'll see where that goes. It should be interesting. For the Weather Brains crew, Kevin Selly, Bill Murray, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters, I'm David Black. We thank you for listening and hope you'll join us again for our next Weather Brains Netcast. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios. Fun show, guys.
This is great. I've been on this show for 4 months, and I'm already being replaced.
Yeah, you're out of it. I was going to say that. You are out of a job, I think.
Maybe I'll send a tape over to that Weather Channel gig. Me and James can tag team that thing.
Well, you know, the story is that she's a lot better looking than you, Kevin, so I think you're out of here, pal. All I can tell you is what's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, we're all out once we get a video podcast. It's over.
All the guys will be in bad trouble. It'll be the blonde squad, Weather Brains, on the vodcast, I think.
We'll have Weather Blondes. How about that?
Hey, that's it. We're twisted. All right, guys. Y'all have fun.
Thanks,
guys. Night.
See ya. Bye.